Wouldn't you love to get paid for doing what you love to do? If you're ready to move on to what's next, join us for Circles of Change with Dr. Zara Larson. Our uplifting live talk show on Saturday mornings from 10 to noon will have you circling back, not running in circles, to pull your experience forward in new ways. Advance your career, plus help others with theirs. Join us Saturdays, 10 to noon, right here on 104.1 The Truth, for pragmatic advice and unconventional wisdom. Circles of Change with Dr. Zara Larson, where your path is created by walking on it. Well, here we are already. What a fast two-hour show with our final guest segment. A pleasure for us to introduce one of our guest authors that flew in from out of town to be part of the Festival of Books. Welcome to Susan Vreeland. How are you this morning, Susan?
Just fine. I'm
great.
Happy to be here.
You bet. You're not worn out yet, hoofing it around and meeting your colleagues and the like?
Full and exciting time.
That's right. And I know that Susan, as our listeners are going to find out, she's no rookie at all to doing book festivals and the like, because she's quite an accomplished author. Let me introduce her. Susan is actually an internationally known author for art-related historical fiction. Her newest book, Clara and Mr. Tiffany, reveals a long-held secret that a free-thinking woman, Clara Driscoll, designed the leaded glass lamps for Tiffany Studios. Four of Susan's six books have been New York Times bestsellers and winners of the Theodore Geisel Award, the highest honor given by the San Diego Book Awards. Working in libraries from junior high through college, where she majored in literature and library science, Susan taught in public high schools for over 30 years. The first of countless trips now to Europe in 1971 and other destinations overseas since then have at first pushed, but now I gather pulled her writing journey forward, particularly when the love of art and the art of loving are involved. Susan's novels have been translated into 26 languages and have frequently been selected as book series picks. Luncheon of the Boating Party constructs Renoir's masterpiece, the personalities involved in its making, and the joie de vivre of late 19th century Paris. Life Studies is a collection of stories of impressionist paintings and contemporary people encouraging art in profound ways. The Girl in Hyacinth Blue traces an alleged Vermeer painting through the centuries, and the Passion of Artemisia illustrates the struggles and triumphs of a female painter in the male art world of Baroque Italy. And then last but not least, The Forest Lover follows rebel British Columbia's painter Emily Carr in her encounters with native peoples and cultures. And dare I say, we already have another project, a work in progress, that's due out in 2014, which is Lizette's List. So Susan, the art and loving, so integral to each of these stories for you, isn't it?
Oh, it is. They complement each other for the creator and for the viewer. For the creator, art is the visible form of love in texture and form and outline and color and subject matter. For any artist to achieve success, he's got to love those elements so much and what he can do with them that it becomes central to his life. And then when it grows that large, one becomes like Cézanne, absolutely absorbed and dedicated. You know, Cézanne painted to live, and he lived to paint. And I dare say that many other artists feel the same way.
Isn't that true? And when you say art in a broader context, not just the visual arts, but even musicians and writers like
absolutely.
Yourself.
Absolutely. Yes.
And I think the other part of it, you'd often hear authors and particularly the fine art say, is that only 50% of the story really is that which they bring to bear, but the other 50% is coming from the viewer. So for yourself as an author, what it must be like to get those first reviews or the email that you get from those who read your stories must be really a broader fulfillment.
Oh, it's not only a fulfillment, it's a teaching instrument. You know, I learn from all of those.
And Susan, the idea I mentioned in the introduction, that first trip in 1971, and you're standing on the bridge in Paris, would you ever thought it would propel you in the direction you've taken now with being a writer?
Oh my gosh, no, because that was before I began to write at all. That was pretty early in my adulthood, and I'm thrilled with how things have progressed and how I was drawn to art more deeply, you know, every year it seems. Exploring art, you know, teaches me to see. It teaches me to be more responsive to the look of things. It teaches me to appreciate color and shape and texture. gosh, what I would miss otherwise.
Yeah, is that true? Well, I know your newest book you wanted to spend some time with us here on the air talking about, and that's Clara and Mr. Tiffany. And I would just ask you, how is it that you came to select that as a theme? Was it the idea starting with a powerful woman whose voice had yet to be heard, or was it the flip that you loved the Tiffany glass and thought I'd go down the history behind it?
Well, probably the first is it was more present in my mind that here was a woman that deserved some recognition and didn't get it in her own lifetime. Tiffany kept her a secret. She was the head of the women's department within Tiffany Studios, and she was the designer, and maybe even she conceived of the whole idea and method of making stained glass lampshades. And we see these reproductions of them all over. But he took credit for it himself. So that kind of irked me. And then as I began to see her actual lamps in an exhibition in the New York Historical Society, I got more involved because of their beauty. And from that show, I took away the catalog, which is a big coffee table size book, and began to read about the method, the glass, her life in New York, the changes in New York at the time, and I got more intrigued. But I knew that if I wanted to pursue this, I would have to read her correspondence, which was unknown until 2005.
Okay. And so then even getting access to her correspondence, was it through the Historical Society that you were able to get to it?
No. The correspondence, although it's not published, is collected in Kent State University Library Special Collections.
How about
because
that?
She was born right near Kent State, and she sent these letters back to her mother and her aunt, who still live there. And another collection was at Queens Historical Society. So they showed me a person who was vibrant and curious and fully engaged in the changes in New York at the time. This time is the turn of the 19th to the 20th century.
Okay, exactly.
So that's the time when skyscrapers were just beginning to be built. I mean, the Brooklyn Bridge wasn't that old. It was only 15 or 20 years old at that time.
And even the role of the Statue of Liberty as it was being completed. And then, of course, the opening chapters about the World's Fair, where Tiffany's, you know, exhibit really started the launch of his business, much bigger so.
Yes, that's true. So New York was just bursting with change and vibrancy. Not the least of which was the flood of immigration. We know that she hired many immigrant girls to work there for her. What an opportunity that was for them.
Yeah, and just a collection of talent that came from so many different parts of the world. So, so Susan, the opportunity for you, the storyline that you've chosen to reveal in this historical fiction, though, is very well rooted in a tremendous amount of research that you did. Was this one of which you did all the research up front, or as you wrote the story, you felt compelled to go in other avenues to verify what suppositions you might be making?
Both.
Okay.
But to begin with, I think I spent 6 months just reading and taking notes. And I didn't explore just how to make a lamp. As I said, the changes in New York and boarding house life in New York where she lived, and even the trolley cars and subway was just beginning. And what must that have been like to take her first subway ride, to go down under the earth, you know? I had to do a lot of research, and I loved the research. Even learning things that were less than happy, like the plight of the immigrants in the tenements.
Sure.
Was all fascinating to me.
And Susan, this period of history that this is placed in, if you can think back your own learnings, you're having been a high school teacher and so on, was this a particular time of history you had always been fascinated with, or were you in any way kind of stretching yourself so you were out of your comfort zone in that regard?
Well, I did stretch myself because I never have lived in New York, and everything I knew I was going to write about it, I had to learn.
Okay,
I had to research, and I had to find out. And I spent about 2 weeks in New York only, but I missed some things. I mean, there's an important scene that takes place in front of the Flatiron Building, and I've never seen the Flatiron Building. So I pored over photographs, but it's that by getting the feel out of my research that gives me the words and the settings and the actions that express that feeling.
Yes, wonderful. Well, Clara and Mr. Tiffany, now, where does love enter into this? And is this a love story, or is this a story about art, or a woman's movement? I mean, where's that love of art, art
kind
of loving?
It's all of those, but it's not a love story in the typical sense. You have one woman and one man, and trace how they get together, because that didn't happen in her life. The title may lead people or entice people to think that there was some romance between Tiffany and Clara. I would not call it romance. I would call it mutual admiration for each other's talents.
Right.
Now, I do want to clarify that this is not the Tiffany who owned the jewelry store, you know, the King of Diamonds. That was Charles Louis Tiffany, the father. This is the son, Louis Comfort Tiffany, that started the Art Nouveau studio of stained glass.
Stained glass, yes.
But no, it wasn't. It's not a love story between the two of them. Sometimes they are annoyed with each other.
Yep, that's right.
Sometimes Clara is disappointed that Tiffany doesn't support her in things. Yet we have to recognize that, you know, there was no other St. Glass studio or even arts and crafts studio in New York to hire women.
That's right.
And so we have to kind of acknowledge that. There were five men in Tiffany's, in Clara's life, one of whom is Tiffany. And the other was a first husband who died only 2 years after they were married. And then there was a man who, with whom she became engaged. He was an important character, even though he wasn't in the book very much, because he was a director of the settlement house in Lower East Side. And from him, I think she learned the value of giving immigrants a chance. But they took a trip together before they were married, which shows that she was a modern woman.
That's true.
And he disappeared from that trip. They woke up one morning and she saw him go out the door, and she never saw him again.
And so the story unwinds. It's a very, very complicated themes and connections for her, as you say, becoming a modern woman in a less than modern age in some ways, but also her passion for the art and returning continually to be connected with Mr. Tiffany.
Yeah.
Now tell me, the fact that each one of your novels is, for the most part, they are art-related themes. I take it that connects to your own passion and love for the visual arts, as we talked about. But any other reason? I mean, obviously, there's a lot of material impossibility with the masterpieces that are out there and otherwise. But you've done such a fine job with these, grounding your work around pieces of art.
Well, I think it's so important because art has the effect of stimulating our imagination. I think that's crucial to our civilization. You know, thanks to art, instead of seeing only one world, the one we live in, or the time period we're living in, we can see other time periods, other worlds, other cultures, and then we become broader. And each time we enter imaginatively into the life of another person in another culture or time period, I think it's a small step upwards in the elevation of the human race. I think that's how important it is.
And if I recall reading some wonderful work, autobiographical, that you've done on a retrospection, that you actually have artists in your family lineage, with your father being a painter?
No, my grandfather.
Grandfather.
And a great-grandfather.
Grandfather. And so the idea that, in fact, you were even referred to in Publishers Weekly, that you paint your canvas with the sure strokes of a talented artist. What do you think they meant by that? And do you feel like you had the hands of your grandfather and your step-grandfather right behind you?
Maybe not the hands, but the eyes.
The eyes. I like that, yeah?
Yeah, so I can respond to color and shape, and I can pore over photographs, and I can go where the story takes place and observe, and from that observation bring alive the art history into a story.
Do you, and we've mentioned, of course, that you've had 6 books published here in this particular space, and you're in the 7th right now. Do you feel your style of inquiry, whether it be your research, Susan, or how you then translate the stories, has it evolved or changed dramatically since you began? Or do you feel you've found a formula?
Recently. Yeah, I think it has recently, because my novel I'm working on now, Lizette's List, is far more fictional than these others. In fact, the artists involved, Chagall, Cezanne, and Pissarro, are only there for a small portion of the novel, just a couple chapters, cameo appearances, you might call them.
Sure.
And the main thrust of the novel is outside of them and purely fictional.
Okay. And was that by design or by happenstance?
Yes.
It is by design.
No, I felt that if I continued to choose an artist whom I loved and brought to life part of that artist's life,
mm-hmm.
I would grow stale.
Okay.
And I needed to launch out and be more imaginative on my own, and it's perhaps a more creative process.
And
I still do research, though.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Every bit the research is important. That authenticates the direction you're going to go. If anything, can help you shelter, influences that might be just pop culture as opposed to the real deal.
Yeah. Well, this is also a historical piece. It takes place just before, during, and after World War II in the south of France, where I love to be and write about.
I was going to say, that's I'll take another trip there. Thank you very much for research. I'm like, I think I'd like to build that off of Vreeland LLC. I'll do that. Well, Susan, have you ever been, ever thought about writing nonfiction explorations of any of these authors or artists as opposed to your novel choice?
Not for a split second.
Not for a split second. I like that one.
No, I am not an art historian. I'm a storyteller. You know, consider what the differences are. An art history can give us an appreciation of a painter's work, but the view is from the onlooker.
Right. Yes.
While fiction invites us to the artist's inner nature, takes us to his bosom, makes us feel the artist's strong emotions, struggle, ecstasy, the physical and mental exhaustion that comes after a period of time at a canvas or a piece of marble, frustration at limited skills, despair at creeping age, arthritis
that's
of the
right.
fingers,
yep,
financial
right.
ruin, doubt,
sure. yep.
ridicule, scorn, all of those things are present in the artist's lives that I have explored. And so I have to, I love to get it down in their voice.
Right, yeah.
and not as a reporter from the outside.
Yeah, that's very well, beautifully put. Not for a second. I love that emphatic nature you gave us to that one. Of course, you've taken multiple trips to Paris, and as well as many other locations around the world. I've got to imagine there's nothing more magical for you than to go and visit the Louvre. But can it not be rather overwhelming, because you must have all your characters from all your books following you around while you're there?
Oh, yeah, maybe so. That's right. You have to take the Louvre in, not in one gulp.
Right.
You have to take it in sips, maybe on multiple trips to Paris. But can I tell you a little story?
I'd love to hear one.
About what happened on the way to the Louvre. A funny thing happened on the way to the Louvre. While I was writing Lunch and the Boating Party, I needed to know, I needed to have my character Renoir see a particular painting by the Italian painter Veronese. Because it involved the angle of a table that he wanted to use in his painting, Lunch and the Boating Party.
Mm-hmm.
So when I was there, I went to the room where on the map it says that painting is closed, locked, with a guard outside saying, closed for renovation. I was devastated. So I asked the guard in broken French at that time, trying to appeal to him to let me in for this need of seeing this. Impossible, madame, he would say. And I went to about three or four other guards with the same thing. Impossible, madame. And finally, one guard pointed to an information desk, and I waited there and tried to explain my need to the person at the desk, and finally she gave me a phone number to call. Well, that was a challenge to figure out how to
use the phone, right?
Make a phone call in France. I did, though. I get through to this man. I didn't know who he was, and he said, meet me at such and such a door at 2 o'clock. So I did. He took me right into the Louvre, right through this renovation, the repainting, the paint buckets, the ladders, to this painting, and stood there with me for more than a half an hour, talking about it with me. So that was step one in this. I marveled about it. And he did not know the connection between that painting, that Italian painting, and Renoir's painting. Because Renoir's painting was sold very soon after it was finished, about 20 years after. And it left France. So this man had never seen it.
Don't you love it?
So that's not the point of the story. I told him that I would send him all the research that I had about that, about Renoir's Lunch and the Boating Party and the connection with his painting in the Louvre, which I did. And he thanked me in a letter. And come to find out, in his letter, he signed it, Monsieur Jean Aubert, Conservateur en Chef de la Peinture Européenne, Chief Conservator of European Paintings.
So all that tells me, Susan, that you're a lady that's had her mind made up, and they know how to pull in the big guns when they need to appease your requests.
So. I guess so.
Bravo, bravo.
If I just have time to say one more thing. A year later, I went back because I needed to know where that painting was in Renoir's time.
Yes.
So he took me into the archives of the Louvre and showed me this big folder about this painting. And we flipped through the pages, and finally we got to the most recent note, page of a note, and it said, on such and such a date, American novelist Susan Freeland came to study and see this painting in preparation for the writing of Luncheon of the Boating Party. So there I was, in the Louvre.
In the Louvre, and from one quick let me in the room to now in the archives of the Louvre. Well, congratulations. Oh, what a pleasure. Susan Vreeland, her latest book, Clara and Mr. Tiffany, thank you so much for joining us. And our listeners, do come and join Susan and I tomorrow at 11:30 at the Integrated Learning Center, room 140. We're going to be joined by two other authors for a marvelous panel to continue this conversation. Tucson is so grateful that you came to town. We'll see you soon, Susan.
Yes, good. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Change is chaotic. That is, unless you embrace it, going places you hadn't dreamed were possible. The Larson Group, Architects of Change, is a leadership consulting, executive coaching, and career transition firm. We help individuals make the most of their current employment situation or to step forward confidently into a career transition. Contact us at thelarsongroup.com or toll free 1-877-544-2580. The Larson Group, Architects of Change, helping others unleash potential through transformational change. 1-877-544-2580.